Lecture 2, Offer and Acceptance.
This topic is offer and acceptance. Offer and acceptance is, of course, agreement, which we talked about as being critical to contract. So offer and acceptance is probably the most disputed and litigated issue in all of all contract law. And offer and acceptance starts with the offer. Now, the offer has several requirements. Again, you might not know an offer when you see one because it has legal requirements. The first and probably the foremost requirement of an offer is a serious intention to be bound. For something to be an offer, you must show a serious intention to be bound. So, suppose that a particularly romantic fellow were proposing marriage, and he fell down on his knees before his beloved and said, "Please marry me, dear. If you marry me, I'll give you the moon and the stars." Now, this woman was a serious, modern, 90s woman with an MBA. She quickly calculates the value of the moon and the stars, and she's thinking the marketing, the advertising potential alone is astronomical, if you'll forgive the pun. So she says, "Heck yes, I accept. Now, where's title? I want title. I want to see. I didn't know you owned the moon and the stars." He said, I didn't really mean literally give you the moon and the stars. Well, did they have a contract? No, of course not. That did not look like a serious intention to be bound. No one in her position should reasonably expect to be given the moon and the stars under the circumstances. So, when is there not a serious intention to be bound? In the ordinary contracts, that means look for things like humor. You know, if somebody's making a joking offer, it's not a real offer for you to accept. Or anger. If somebody is standing outside of their car, which is smoking, and they pound on the hood and say, "I'd sell this junker for 5 cents," and you happen to be driving by and you shout out, "I accept. Do you have a contract?" No, probably not. He doesn't look like he's seriously offering to sell his car for 5 cents. He's just angry. And the key here is, it's an objective test. It's what the reasonable offeree listener thinks would be a serious intention to be bound. So you cannot get out of a contract simply by saying, "Oh, down deep, I was really joking when I offered to sell you my car." That's not any good. If you look like you're making a serious offer, you are. But it's got to look serious. It can't look like it's out of anger or humor or something like that. Another thing that's not an offer is an expression of opinion. Suppose you're saying, "Well, I'm thinking of selling my land." And somebody says, "Well, what do you think it's worth?" And you say, "Oh, I think my land's probably worth about $50,000. He says, "I accept." No, you didn't make an offer. You just gave your opinion of what your land was worth. You didn't make an offer to sell it to him for $50,000. He can't accept that. In terms of business transactions, a particularly significant feature of this rule is that advertisements are not offers. There are some exceptions. But as a general rule, advertisements, or as we say in Texas, advertisements, are not offers. And this makes sense if you think about it. Suppose you were selling your house and you put a little picture of it and a little advertisement in the paper. If that were an offer, half a dozen people could come to you and say, "I accept." You can't very well sell your house to half a dozen different people. I mean, they all want it for themselves, not share, right? So an advertisement is not an offer. Under the law, an advertisement generally is an invitation to make offers. You put an advertisement in the paper or someplace, you're inviting people, "Come on in and make me an offer, I'll probably accept." You also have to look to the fact that preliminary negotiations are not necessarily offers. We talked about before Kim Basinger and the creeping contract. For a while there in negotiations, people are throwing numbers back and forth. "I want this, you know, I'm be interested in that, you've got to throw this in." Those things usually are not offers. Offers have got to look like a full-fledged expression of a deal that I'm offering for you to say, "I accept, and if you say that, then we've got a deal." So it's got to look like there's a serious intention to be bound for there to be an offer. Second requirement of an offer is called definiteness. An offer must have reasonably definite terms. You've got to know what the deal is, or it's not an offer. Thus, I couldn't say to you, well, I tell you what, if you promise to pay me $1,000, I'll give you something. And you, out of naivete or out of the thought that, you know, I'm such a nice guy, you say, yeah, sure, I accept. just out of curiosity, right? Would that be a contract? Did I make you an offer? I'll give you something for $1,000? No, there's no, we have no, it's something. That could be anything. It has no meaning. Which means that a court would have no way of enforcing that. Suppose you gave me $1,000 and I gave you nothing. And you go into court and sue, and the court would say, well, you have to give him something. I mean, how would you enforce that? So, even on Let's Make a Deal, you have definiteness, or you did. I guess it's still in syndication. You know, you don't know what's in the box, but you know which box it is. That's all the definiteness you need. You don't even have to know what's in the box, but you've got to know which box it is for definiteness. Now, this brings me to Piatt v. Piatt, or one that is colloquially known around the law school as the Men Are Scum case. Okay? So here's what happened in Piatt v. Piatt. Charles and Margaret Piatt were undergraduates at the University of Arizona, and they fell in love and chose to marry. So they get married. But they both want advanced degrees. You know, in America today, you got to have a graduate degree. They both want advanced degrees. But Charles goes to Margaret and says, you know, we could both go on, continue our education with our advanced degree, but that's not a good way to start out a marriage. We'll be very poor, right? Wouldn't it make more sense if one of us gets the degree while the other one works, and then when the first one has the degree and starts work, the second one can get the degree? She says, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense. It'd be nice to have a little more money, you know, make a home and all that. So then, guess who gets the degree first? Charles goes to law school, you know, which should have been a forewarning to her, but it wasn't. He goes to law school. He gets his law degree. And she says, oh, good, now I can go to graduate school. He says, well, wait a minute. If we both worked for a year, think about how much money we'd have. We could have a really nice vacation. She says, well, yeah, okay, I'll wait a year. So they waited. And about that year's about up, and guess what? I don't think this is going to shock or surprise you too much. Charles wants a divorce. And Charles gets a divorce. Now, where does this leave Margaret? Well, in a divorce, of course, you divide up the community property, as would the case be. But that doesn't do her any good, because all that community property was stuff she put into the marriage, because she was the one who was working, right? And what she wants is the money to go to graduate school. So she sues, saying, we had a contract that he would put me through graduate school after I put him through graduate school. The court, though, said no. Now, a cynic would say that's because the judge was probably a male. But the judge's reasoning was that the contract was too indefinite. It said he would put her through graduate school, but it didn't say where, and it didn't say in what. And there's a considerable difference in cost between a PhD at Harvard and an MBA at some state school. So since the contract was not definite enough to say what the graduate degree was, there's no contract. It's not definite enough. We can't give her a remedy. Thus, the Men Are Scum case. Now, the court did say that maybe she can recover in quasi-contract. Remember, quasi-contract is where we look to fairness. I think in this case, fairness is on her side. And we look to the fact they would have made a contract if they could have. And the court reasoned that Charles and Margaret may really have meant to make a deal, may have meant to make a contract way back when, after they got married. They just didn't know the terms of contract law, so they didn't know it had to be definite. So she might be able to recover in quasi-contract. I don't know if she ever did. Here's another place where the definiteness issue comes up in the real world. Sometimes people will make a contract where they'll agree to work for a salary and a reasonable share of the profits, or a fair share of the profits. That may sound like a good deal, but it's worthless to get a contract for a reasonable share of the profits or a fair share of the profits. That's so indefinite. How do you know what's reasonable? How do you know what's fair? those contracts are struck down, or the share of the profits part of those contracts are struck down for indefiniteness. So when you're making a contract, you want to get all the details in there that you can. Now, the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, remember we talked about that, has relaxed this definiteness requirement a great deal. You don't need much definiteness if the UCC applies. But the UCC only applies to the sale of goods. It doesn't apply to services like employment contracts, so it does no good there. Nor would it apply to a PIAT v. PIAT type case. So while the UCC makes this easier for big companies with big sales of goods, you don't even have to specify a price anymore. The court will just plug in a reasonable price. It doesn't apply to services contracts, which is where the definiteness criterion remains important. Okay, third requirement of the offer is communication. Communication. An offer must be communicated to the offeree, the person receiving the offer. What this means is that suppose you hear there are a lot of good deals to be had on Wall Street, so you walk around Wall Street saying, "I accept, I accept. Nice to meet you, sir. I accept." On the off chance that one of them has an offer in their pocket, right? And you can take it. No, that doesn't work. You can't accept an offer that's not been communicated to you. And probably the case where this really came up and was sort of interesting was in a reward case. Suppose there is a reward out for the capture of such and such a felon person. And you capture such and such a felon person and turn him in. You didn't know about the reward. I mean, you just were doing your duty as a good citizen. Then later you find out about the reward, and you say, "Hey, there's a reward, I get money," right? Sorry, wrong. In a contract, there's got to be consideration. And if you didn't know about the reward, you didn't catch that felon in exchange for the reward, so you don't get the reward. And it may seem kind of harsh, but that's contract law, I'm sorry. It wasn't communicated to you, the offer was not communicated to you prior to your undertaking the act of acceptance. So those are the main requirements of an offer. Serious attention to be bound, definiteness, and communication. The next thing to talk about, though, is termination of the offer. Because an offer is not like a contract. Once you have a contract, you're bound. You're not bound by your offer until it's accepted. The offeror is really going out on a limb here. If I say to you, "I'll sell you my car for $5,000 now," I am in a tricky little position. All the power is in your hands. If you say you accept, I'm stuck with the deal. I got to take it. But you don't have to say you accept. So all the control is in your hand, which means that while it's in the offer form, I am risking being bound and you're at no risk whatsoever. To take that into account, courts have adopted a doctrine which is the offeror controls the offer. Remember that. The offeror controls the offer. The offeror controls the offer. In fact, I think it helps to animalize this. Think of an offer as a caterpillar. That caterpillar is crawling along the ground here, and it's still an offer. When it's accepted, it becomes a butterfly. And that's a contract. So you have a little offer caterpillar until it's accepted by a chrysalis or something, and it becomes a butterfly contract. So long as it's an offer, so long as it's a caterpillar, it can be terminated, squashed. So if I put out an offer out there, if I offer to sell you, I could say, "I offer to sell you my car for $5, I revoke." Well, I made an offer to sell you my car, and then I revoke that offer. And I can do that. I can revoke it whenever I feel like, in most cases. I can revoke it immediately before you have time to accept. And that's all legitimate. There are only a few cases where the offeror cannot revoke the offer. One of these is pretty intuitive. That would be an option contract. That's where you pay to keep the offer open. I make you an offer. You think it's a good deal, but you're not sure you want to accept. You've got to look into bank financing or something like that. But you don't want to lose the offer. You want to keep it out there for you to accept. And you know your contract law. You know I could revoke it any time. So what do? You pay me to keep the offer open. It's like a separate little contract. You pay me some amount of money, fraction probably, of the general value, and then I have to keep the offer open. If you pay me to keep the offer open, you're paying for an option. Under the UCC, there's another doctrine called a merchant's firm offer, where you have to leave offers open. But this itself illustrates the revocability, how easy it is to squish the caterpillar. Suppose I make an offer to you. Suppose I say, I will work for you for a year for $10,000, and I'll leave this offer open for a week. Suppose I say that to you. And then the next day I say I revoke. Is that legit? It sure is. I don't have to leave that offer open. The UCC makes a specific provision, though, where if I promise to leave an offer open, and I put it in writing, and I sign it, and I say for how long, then I have to leave it open. But most times, that is such a vulnerable little caterpillar walking around out there. Most times, even if I promise to hold the offer open, I don't have to. I don't have to keep my promises, remember? I just have to keep my contracts. The way to keep an offer open is through an option contract. Otherwise, the offeror can revoke it any time he or she wants. That's one way that an offer dies. That's one way to squash the caterpillar, by revocation. A second way is by rejection or counteroffer. Rejection or counteroffer. If I make an offer to you and you say, ha, no way, oops, I mean yes. Do we have a contract? Do we have a butterfly? No. As soon as you say no, the caterpillar is squashed. You cannot revive a squashed caterpillar. As soon as you reject my offer, it is gone, and you can't change your mind. Likewise, if you make a counter offer, if you say, that's no good, but I'll pay you XYZ for it, that squashes my original caterpillar offer too. Now you're the offeror. It's your offer on the table, and I'm the one in the position of choosing whether or not to accept. So this is why the offeree, which is the person who does the accepting, of course, has to be careful what she says. If not, they run the risk of squashing the caterpillar and losing their offer, losing their opportunity to accept an offer. So what do? Well, you can make a counter-inquiry without killing the offer. You can make a counter-inquiry. You can say, ooh, I don't know about that price. Would you be interested in a little bit less? Would you lower the price a little bit? That's called a counter-inquiry. That doesn't squash the caterpillar. But a counteroffer, a clear counteroffer does. So it's important if you receive an offer that you know you have to be careful what you say or you may lose the offer. Now, there's a third way that an offer is terminated, and that is by operation of law. Sometimes the law ends the offer. That would be a case such as where the subject matter is destroyed. If I'm offering to sell you my house, and it happens to be in Southern California, and it happens to be on a fault, and there's an earthquake and it destroys the house, the offer is gone. Likewise, lapse of time may end an offer. Well, now the offeror shouldn't let this happen. You know, if I make you an offer and you take too long, I should have the presence of mind to say, I revoke. Get that offer out of there. But suppose I make a lot of offers. Suppose I just go around making offers and I forget some of them. So there's one that's been sitting out there for 6 years. And you've just been waiting for the, you know, watching the market, waiting for the commodities to change. And after 6 years, you say, yeah, now it looks pretty good. I accept. You telegram me back and say, I accept. Now, the law will cancel it automatically itself after a lapse of time. How much time? No firm rule. Depends on the commodities in question. You know, obviously, an offer for a house will presumably be held open for quite a bit of time. An offer for a commodity that fluctuates rapidly in value, however, offer for gold probably won't be held open very long because it's obviously based on the current price of gold, which changes. Okay, that's it now for the offer, the first part. The next issue is the acceptance. So you've got an offer out there. How do you accept? How do you turn the caterpillar into a butterfly? First, what is the method of acceptance? Ordinarily, the method of acceptance is anything that's reasonable, anything that's reasonable in light of the offer. Which means that if the offer were sent to you by mail, sending the acceptance by mail is almost certainly reasonable. Maybe not Pony Express. However, go back to remember our rule that the offeror controls the offer. The offeror can also specify the method of acceptance, if they want. I could make you an offer and say, in order to accept this, you have to walk in on your hands, clapping your feet together and barking like a seal. And in order to accept my offer, you've got to do that. That's part of my offer. That's part of the terms. You've got to do it. So method of acceptance, you've got to figure out the right method of acceptance. Secondly, you must demonstrate a serious intention to accept. A serious intention to accept. This is much like a serious offer. You've got to show a serious and fairly unequivocal intention to accept. If I say, I accept if it's okay with my wife, that's not an acceptance. It's got to be clearer than that. And third, an acceptance also requires communication. If you want to accept an offer, you've got to tell the offeror. Don't keep it to yourself. You know, if somebody makes you an offer, you weigh it in your mind, you balance the pros and cons, you finally decide, it's a good deal, I accept. You go to sleep. And then you wake up in the morning and you discover the offer's been revoked. And you say, hey, no, you can't, I accepted it last night. Well, no, just make up your mind to accept it isn't good enough. You've got to tell that offeror. However, the law has made it easier. The law has made it a little bit easier to get your acceptance accepted as fast as possible, which we're going to talk about just a little bit later. Now, these acceptance issues are not too great a problem. There is one, though, that is a great problem in contracts, and that is an acceptance varying from the offer, where the terms of the acceptance are different from the terms of the offer. Under the traditional law, the common laws that developed from Merry Old England through all the judges of Merry Old England to the judges of the colonial states, we had something called the mirror image rule. The mirror image rule, which was that the acceptance had to accept the offer literally, every jot and tittle, as they say. You couldn't make any changes if you wanted to accept. If you're going to make any changes, it would be a counteroffer. And that was all part of the theory that contract acceptance involves a meeting of the minds. That is, we don't have a contract unless each side has a meeting of the minds on what the terms are. Now, obviously, if the acceptance has different terms from the offer, you don't have a meeting of the minds. You've got different terms. You don't have a deal. You don't have a contract. That was the old mirror image rule, which may still be applied in some cases, but is not applied under the UCC. There's a famous UCC section 2-207, probably the most litigated of all in Title II of the UCC, where they relax the mirror image rule considerably. Here's why. You people have done some business from time to time, have ordered things. And how do we do business? Well, typically, the sale of goods involves first some sort of advertising circular or catalog. Is that an offer? No. Advertisements are not offers, generally. They are invitations to make offers. So, okay, it's not an offer. What is it? It's an invitation to make offers. So what do you decide you want some of their products? What do you do? You send in a purchase order. And you may well have a standard purchase order form for your firm. And I don't know if you've ever looked at it closely, but I'll bet if you look at that standard purchase order form and then turn over to the other side, you'll find lots of tiny print. And these are all these little detailed contract provisions that are all skewed to your side, right? Where you win if anything goes wrong, basically. And you send that off to the seller. Now, what does the seller do? The seller probably sends you your goods with a confirmation, or maybe sends you a confirmation before you receive your goods. And what does that confirmation have? That confirmation has the basics on the front, you know, what you want, at what price, all that. But then you turn it over and it's got all this tiny little print terms. And what's that? That is a bunch of contract terms skewed to their side. So you don't have your classic mirror image acceptance. You've both throwing out your own little contract terms here, some of which may be totally different and some of which may even conflict. So you don't have a contract, right? Well, the theory behind the UCC was, no, we don't want to rest too much of the law on technicalities here. We think that those two companies, those two parties, basically had a meeting of the minds. Essentially, they wanted to buy this much of this product at this price. That's all the meeting of the minds we probably need. If it appears that the parties indeed had a serious intention to contract, as if they intended to make a contract, without necessarily insisting on every little term. We'll call it a contract. So, we'll call it a contract. Well, that's a start. Now we have a contract. What are the terms? I mean, you've got your tiny little terms. I've got my tiny little terms. Whose tiny little terms win? There are some rules here. First, the offeror's terms in the purchase order, those are presumptively part of the contract. They're in. What about the offeree, the person doing the accepting? What about their terms? Are they in? Well, let's assume they're not conflicting. Let's assume they're just additional terms. Are they in? Yes, they're probably in too. Under the law, those new terms are probably in as part of the contract, unless. Okay, unless what? Unless the offeror promptly rejects them. You know, if you take the time to read through the tiny little terms on the back of the confirmation and you see one that you really dislike, you can send a letter off and say, wait, we reject this term. Then it's not part of the contract. Or the offer precludes them, unless your offer says the very first part, no additional terms. Or the terms make a material alteration. This can be complicated. The terms are presumptively in unless the offeror rejects them, or they make a material alteration. What is the material alteration? Well, it could be a new suit, but it's not. A material alteration is something that is so significant that it is out of the ordinary course of business in this area. A material alteration would be something like, there are no warranties whatsoever on this product. That would be a material, that's too significant to slip in through the back door. You want a really significant provision like that, you've got to make it obvious and you've got to get clear acquiescence from the other side. So this UCC 2-207 is important for slipping in minor tiny little terms, but does not allow you to slip in something enormous that really the offeror needs to see and understand and accept. Okay, what if the tiny little terms are in conflict? What if they're different? And this may be something like, you know, is payment to be within 35 days or 45 days, something like that. How do we decide if one says payment at 35 and one says payment at 45? How the heck do we decide when payment has to be within? And once again, I'm ending sentences with prepositions, sorry. The law uses something that is called the knockout rule, generally. This is not universally accepted. But under the knockout rule, if the tiny little terms conflict, they're both gone. They both go away. So that's a start. Now, how do we know when payment should be within a preposition? Winston Churchill's beyond me. When do we decide when payment has to be? We look to what the law would say if there were no term. We look to what the law, if there were no term, what would the presumptive rule be? That's what we implement. So, what's the practical significance of all of this? Well, the practical significance of this is that suppose you are an offeror. You're making an offer via a purchase order or something like that. I'd say for you, you need to look at those tiny little terms in the confirmation, knowing that you can reject them if they seem too unacceptable to you. The trickier question is, what if you want to accept a contract? What if you want to accept a contract and you want to get your tiny little terms into the contract? You run some risk here, because remember, the offeror could reject them. If you want to insist on a term, you had better make it a condition of your acceptance. You had better say, I accept only if I get this additional term. Then it's not an acceptance, it's a counteroffer. But that's the only way to be sure that you get it in. All right. Next, when acceptance takes effect. This is our last issue, because this is kind of an interesting one, too, that's created some controversy. When does an acceptance take effect? And we have something in the law called the mailbox rule. Now, of course, as the information superhighway spreads across America, the whole concept of a mailbox will seem strange and old-fashioned. But it's still called the mailbox rule. What this means is that an acceptance takes effect at the time you mail that acceptance off, not at the time it's received. Now, in general, most of these communications, an offer, a revocation, a rejection, they don't really take effect until they're communicated, which means until they're received. But an acceptance takes effect when it's put in the mailbox. So you have accepted this offer before the offeror even knows it. This creates a tricky little situation, which I'm just going to use a case to illustrate. There was an anti-nuclear group in New Hampshire, which was called the Clamshell Alliance. And they wanted to conduct a rally against this New Hampshire nuclear power plant. They did not want operated or built or whatever. And so they wanted to rent the National Guard Armory, and they inquired, how do we go about renting the National Guard Armory? The armory sent back an offer to rent on certain terms. It says, we'll rent you the armory for such and such a price. You have to agree to do such and such, clean it up, whatever. Okay. Now, let's say on Monday, I don't know what day of the week it is, but on Monday, the Clamshell Alliance group signed the offer and put it in the outbox of their on their desk to be mailed. Okay, on the next day, Tuesday, the governor of New Hampshire, Meldrum Thompson at that time, a very conservative guy who doesn't want anti-nuclear folk in his National Guard armories. So he told the National Guard people, revoke that offer, we can't have these people here. So the very next day, the National Guard called up the Clamshell Alliance and said, the offer is revoked. The day after that, the acceptance arrives. Is there a contract? The answer is yes. Because you notice the government of New Hampshire, the armory, revoked that offer, which is their right to do as an offeror, before they had received the acceptance. But after the acceptance had been sent. So under the mailbox rule, that offer was formed as soon that the caterpillar became a butterfly, as soon as the acceptance was put into the mailbox. You can't squish a butterfly. You can squish the caterpillar with revocation, but not the, you wouldn't want to squish a butterfly. You can't squish the butterfly, which means that they had a contract and they had a right to use the armory because the acceptance occurred before the revocation. The acceptance occurred as soon as it was put into the mail. So that's kind of a tricky little thing for the offeror. Your offer might be accepted out there somewhere in the U.S. mails, and you don't even know it. Which is why, you know, you might want to keep in close contact with the people to whom you make offers, and why you might not, as we get more, we get faxes and modems and all these new high-tech systems, this rule may become less important because you can accept and have it received instantly. A good offeror will probably insist on that, probably insist that you have to communicate your acceptance by fax or by modem or something so that you don't have that period of uncertainty out there. Okay, now, let's talk about some review cases, some illustration cases for what we've gone through today. How about this one? You're working for a company, and that company promises to provide you with a medical insurance program. Okay, the Clinton Health Plan's not passed yet. We don't know if it will be. But your company is promising you medical insurance. So you think, great, okay. You go out and in the course of your hazardous work, out there working around filling stations, I didn't tell you what your job was, but you're working around filling stations, you're badly burned in a gas explosion. You say, well, at least I have medical insurance. Wrong. The company never bought you medical insurance. So you sue the company, right? They promised to provide you medical insurance. That was part of your contract. Do you think you should be able to recover from the company on their promise to provide you medical insurance? One court said, no, you don't. What does medical insurance mean? Remember, it's like graduate school in Piatt v. Piatt. Medical insurance could be any number of things. There's no guarantee your medical insurance they promised was going to cover this type of accident, this type of injury. Too indefinite, no contract. Well, that's pretty tough. This definiteness requirement can lead to some pretty tough, seemingly sort of unfair results. I suppose this fellow might have had some sort of quasi-contract claim, although, as I said earlier, those are hard to win. That's just another reason why it's important to know contract law, so you can make sure that you're not relying on contract terms that are so indefinite that you're not going to be able to recover. Okay, let me give you another one. Let's talk some about some offers. This is another famous case. There was a fancy coat store, fur coats, back when they were more politically acceptable to wear fur coats. And they put an advertisement in the paper that said, "We'll sell you fur coats, first come, first served, for $1 each, starting Saturday morning." So their theory is they want to get a lot of people lined up here Saturday morning, and the first three there waiting at the door are going to get these great deals on fur coats, and then I suppose they hope this will get them lots of publicity so they'll sell more fur coats, right? Well, so the morning comes, and the first person at the door is a guy named Lefkowitz. The store says, "We did not mean men. We meant the first three women. The first three women get coats for a dollar. We don't want to sell our coats to men." I don't know why this was such a big deal to them, but it was. So they refused to sell him the coat for $1. Now, he sued the store and said, "They promised I went to all this trouble to get down there early, be first in line. I should get my $1 for a coat." Now, the store has an obvious defense that I'm sure you all are thinking of. That is, an advertisement is not an offer. You cannot accept an advertisement. It's an invitation to make offers. He went there, he made an offer, we rejected it, because he was a man. But there's a loophole. The store lost, he won. Here is why. I told you an advertisement generally was not an offer, but here is an exception where it is an offer. Where the advertisement specifies the number of items for sale, the means for allocating those items among the people who show up, that is, first come, first served, and has all the other terms, such as price, in that case, it is an offer. And so he could accept it. He could legitimately accept this offer. And so he won, and he gets his fur coat for a dollar. This was long enough ago, it wasn't quite as good a deal as it might seem today, but it was still a pretty good deal. So an advertisement generally is not an offer. If your supermarket has an advertisement for a particular can of tomato sauce or something for 10 cents, and you rush in and say to the cashier, "I'll take 2 million, that's not an acceptance. They didn't make an offer enabling you to take 2 million. And in fact, sometimes you see in the paper, you know, that sometimes you go to the store and you find, "Oh, that was a typo. We're very sorry. Very sorry, that was a typo. You can't accept that. Meant to be $10. Those generally are not offers that you can rush in and accept. But if the advertisement says, "Here, we're selling this many, and here's how we're going to apportion them among the people who come, that is first come, first served," then it's an offer, and you can accept it and make it into a binding contract. Okay, let me give you a couple other cases related to this. There was a manufacturer at a state gambling commission who went on a televised hearing. You know, now that we have cable, they televise everything. You can be a very informed citizen if you follow your cable. So this was a state gambling commission hearing that was televised. And this manufacturer was a manufacturer of something called punch boards, which is a gambling game I've never played, but I guess it's a good one. And he said, "I'll pay $100,000 to anybody who finds a crooked punch board produced by my company." You know, a man of integrity. I'll pay $100,000 to anybody who finds a crooked punch board, you know, one that's rigged. Somehow you can rig them. Well, someone out there had one, a crooked, rigged punch board produced by his company. So he calls up the manufacturer and says, "I heard you make that offer on $100,000 for a crooked punch board. Were you serious about that?" And the manufacturer, of course, full of bluster and integrity and all that, says, "Well, heck yes, I'm sure about that. There are no crooked punch boards out there. I'll pay." So the guy then brings in the crooked punch board and says, "Hey, look, see, here's a crooked game board. I get $100,000. And the manufacturer said, "Well, yes, I see it is crooked, but forget it. I'm not going to pay you." Wasn't really an offer. It was just bluster. Me in front of the camera. So how should that one come out? Well, that one comes down to our issue of, did it look like a serious and objective intent to make an offer? And particularly because the fellow who had the crooked punch board called in to say, "Are you serious?" And the manufacturer said, "Yes, sure, it looks like a serious intention to make an offer." So it was a contract offer, It was accepted by the guy, so he gets his $100,000. I'll give you a case to contrast with that. See how changing the facts can change the results in some of these cases. There was a nationally famous tax avoider who was on national TV. You almost wonder, how can someone be a nationally famous tax avoider, right? Why doesn't the IRS, you know, do something about it? But there are people out there who are nationally famous, and they write these books, you know, how to not pay taxes. And anyway, this guy actually got interviewed on some TV show. And he said, there is no provision in the Internal Revenue Service, in the Internal Revenue Code, that requires you to pay income taxes. He said it was legal not to pay taxes, because there's nothing in the Internal Revenue Code that says you have to. And if somebody can show me a provision in the Internal Revenue Code that says you have to pay taxes, I'll pay you $10,000 or something, right? Well, 2 days later, he gets a call from a guy who says, well, I looked and I found it here. It says you have to pay your taxes. And the tax avoider says, well, yeah, but I'm not going to pay you. It's not serious, right? Well, so does the tax avoider have to pay? This time they said no. Well, what's the difference? Well, you look at the terms of the offer. The offeror controls the offer. And the court went back and looked at the video of this fellow offering on national TV and decided what he was really saying was, if you call in during the rest of this show and cite to me the Internal Revenue Code, then I will pay you your reward. Since this guy waited 2 days, the court decided that the offer had terminated by lapse of time. Remember, an offer terminates by lapse of time. The offer had terminated by lapse of time, so the acceptance, while it was, it did look like a perfectly good, legitimate offer at the time it was made. It had to be accepted there that day, and since time had lapsed, the acceptance was no good, so there was no contract. Kind of interesting to think about offer and acceptance in just your everyday contracts. When you go to the supermarket, there's an agreement there, so there's got to be an offer and acceptance somewhere, but where does it happen? So when you take the stuff off the shelves, is it when you present them to the cashier? One common question about offer and acceptance involves auctions. When you're at an auction, and they've got this item up there for sale, right? And you're raising your hand to buy it, and somebody else is, and then somebody always coughs or rubs their nose by accident and buys a $2 million bizarre statue or something, right? Well, somewhere in there at the end, there's probably a contract, but where does it happen? In other words, when you tentatively raise your hand and bid something, do you have a contract? The way the courts have decided to resolve this is as follows. The presentation of the object by the auctioneer is an invitation to make offers, just like an advertisement. When you raise your hand and bid something, that is an offer. That is the offer, when you bid something. And then somebody else bids something, and that's another offer, and then that's another. And the auctioneer is standing up there waiting for the best offer. And that's the point of the hammer. You know, I thought the hammer was just for show and drama. But, you know, wham. That, when the hammer comes down, it is generally an acceptance. That is when the offer is accepted. So this means, you should feel safer about going to auctions. There are all those cases where Dick Van Dyke or somebody went to an auction and, you know, rubbed his nose and accidentally bid something and then, you know, prayed for somebody else to make another, and then they didn't, and so he bought something stupid, right? Well, in fact, because when he rubbed his nose and accidentally made an offer, he was just making an offer, which meant he could jump up and shout, I revoke, or, you know, rub his head or whatever it means to speak, I revoke, and then he's out of it. So offer and acceptance is important in contracts, because until you have offer and acceptance, you don't have a butterfly, you've just got a caterpillar, and it can be squashed.